You may proceed.
Good morning, Justice Lemon and Justices of the Court. Peter Greenspun on behalf of Mr. Shannon. First, I appreciate the court expediting this matter on the docket. I know that that interferes with the typical docket management of the court, but given the circumstances, it's appropriate in this case. We do ask that the court of, that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals. The issue, I think, is pretty well briefed, as set out in our brief, and the Commonwealth, this is one of the few cases I have with a total record that is less than an inch, which means that I didn't lose at trial yet, I suppose. What we have here is a man where the General District Court grants bond. It's a presumption against bond case. The judge considered that, grants bond. The Commonwealth appealed immediately. The next day, the Circuit Court grants bond. The Commonwealth's position that the court did not consider the presumption issues is belayed by the record itself, as at page 29 of the appendix, the Commonwealth referred to the presumption against bond in its argument against bond on the appeal motion in the Circuit Court. There was concession on August 22nd on the Commonwealth's motion to stay the granting of the bond so that they could file a motion for review. The Commonwealth concedes that the issue was not so much a flight risk, and they don't really say why Mr. Shannon is ever a generalized risk to the community. They really say you should stay it just because. But the Commonwealth has conceded that there's no flight risk in this case. The Commonwealth then files their motion for review to the Court of Appeals on an argument which they had made to the Circuit Court that they do it very in expeditious fashion. In fact, the decision of the Court of Appeals reversing the Circuit Court was almost 4 weeks later. So Mr. Shannon had been on bond with no issues during that time. The real issue here is, did the Court of Appeals apply the appropriate standard of review in determining that Judge Schell in the Circuit Court abused his discretion? There is no opinion from the Court of Appeals. Even in the per curiam cases where there's a single judge at the Court of Appeals who is reviewing preliminarily cases, we're routinely getting opinions in those instances. When there's an abuse of discretion, if the Court of Appeals had denied the Commonwealth's motion, you can understand a one-paragraph order. However, when there's an order, as the Commonwealth asserts, that would contain an abuse of discretion review, you would expect to have something. Here, the Court of Appeals says that they apply the appropriate standard, applying the requisite standard, sorry, but there is no definition of that, and there is no identification in this record at all as to how the Circuit Court might have abused his discretion. The judge had a lengthy hearing. This was not a summary bond motion. There was extensive argument. There was presentation of pictures, police reports, and so on. There were detailed descriptions of Mr. Shannon's history and so on. There's nothing in the record to indicate that the court was distracted or not paying attention or anything of that nature. For the Court of Appeals to find that the Circuit Court judge had abused his discretion. So the only default that's left is that the Court of Appeals was saying that the Circuit Court that they disagree with the Circuit Court judge. And it's clear from the authorities in this court set forth in our briefs, but that the Court of Appeals a number of times has basically demonstrated a disagreement with the Circuit Court in coming to their conclusions as opposed to applying an abuse of discretion standard. The key or clear case on that is the School Board versus Beasley at 238 Virginia. The Court of Appeals basically, according to this court, redetermined the facts. They had a disagreement with the conclusions of the circuit court. Here, the only thing you can get out of the one-page per curiam order is that there was some disagreement. The judge or judges of the Court of Appeals who considered this said that circuit court judge got this wrong. With the
Mr. Greenspun, the order, which I have before me, doesn't really recite the standard of review that the Court of Appeals used. It simply says the requisite standard of review. I don't know whether they reviewed it de novo in error or whether or not they reviewed it for an abuse of discretion. But let me get to the question here. What do we do with it if we think that there was a faulty standard of review used or one that we can't discern? Do we send it back to the Court of Appeals and tell them what the standard is and let them reconsider this matter? What do we do?
I've thought about that, and the court directed that we address the standard of review, which I think both parties have. Bit of a disagreement there. I think it's the order is to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and to reinstate the bond under the circumstances. The Court of Appeals had a responsibility to follow the rules of this court and to review to an appropriate standard. If the Court of Appeals decision does not support that ruling, then I believe it's no different than in any other case that comes to this court from the Court of Appeals. You reverse and remand for a retrial in the circuit court. And essentially, the Court of Appeals it's really no different than if there was an evidentiary issue, something of that nature. And in that evidentiary issue, this court reversed, as you did in a case that I had a few months ago, the Gardner case out of the Arlington Circuit Court. And the mandate of this court is to the Court of Appeals to its reversed and to send the case back to the circuit court. Otherwise, the Court of Appeal, if the Court of Appeals had said in their order that the circuit court abused its discretion, then this court would have the guidance to be able to perhaps make that decision in some fashion or another. But the Court of Appeals basically would be getting a second shot while Mr. Shannon sits in jail now. Or now, since the middle of September, when his bond was revoked based on their order, on an order without the requisite standard of review stated. So I'm not sure if I'm clear, and if I'm not, it's because it's not 100% clear. It's probably the reason for that. It's sort of a new issue to some extent. Beyond that, the Commonwealth, in their brief, essentially raises a new issue that was not of record as far as the Commonwealth's motion for review. The Commonwealth's motion for review really is a restatement of the facts that are stated in the transcript from the circuit court hearings. They don't cite any authority. The Commonwealth did not cite any authority to the Court of Appeals. They just reiterated the history and what's in the transcript. The Commonwealth now, through the Attorney General's office, attempts to essentially add a new issue, and that is the circuit court judge abused his discretion because he considered improper and irrelevant factors. There's nothing from the Court of Appeals saying that because there's no substantive opinion from the Court of Appeals, and certainly there's no indication from the circuit court transcripts that the circuit court judge ignored factors were considered improper factors. There were no objections from the Commonwealth at all, except as to the result. So at the bottom, what you get to is the Court of Appeals appears to have as a model here, and we've cited to another appeal from the Fairfax Circuit Court. The Court of Appeals issued essentially the same form order. And it seems to be the same practice as in Beasley, where there seems to be a practice to an extent, in some instances anyway, where the Court of Appeals is replacing its judgment for the circuit court and not applying the appropriate standard of review. And that's why, beyond for Mr. Shannon hopefully being released in expeditious fashion, if he's privileged enough to have this court rule in his favor, it's really an important issue as far as other matters are concerned, because the parties, litigants, need to, particularly on expedited review matters, need to know that the Court of Appeals is giving full consideration at the appropriate standard of review. I'd ask to reserve the rest of my time unless there's other questions.
All right.
May it please the Court, my name is Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. First of all, I would argue that the correct standard of review here in this court is de novo. This is a decision of interpreting the Court of Appeals' legal determination. And certainly, I think the question was, how do we know from the order that they applied the correct standard of review? And the answer is that we presume that judges understand what the law is and apply it correctly in absence of evidence to the contrary. And here, they said they applying the correct standard of review in the order. If they were deciding it de novo, they would not have said anything, or rehearing the evidence or reconsidering the evidence, they would not have said anything about any standard of review.
Counsel, let me interrupt you just one second. If what you're saying is correct, does that mean that a court could always insulate itself from review by saying, we did everything correctly?
No, and I mean, I think I've certainly argued that that is an abuse of discretion standard, and this court, of course, can say, I mean, they found that there was an abuse of discretion. They may not have said those words, but that's what they're saying in the order by saying they're applying the correct standard.
How do we review them de novo, which I think you're right, we do. But how do we review them de novo unless we know why they think it's an abuse of discretion? Because the order looks an awful lot like they simply substituted their own view and heard the case de novo themselves. So
well,
how do we do that?
I disagree, Your Honor, because when you look at the order, it says that based upon a review of the record and everything else and applying the correct standard of review, they found that the presumption against Bond had not been rebutted. I mean, other than saying the words abuse of discretion.
That we've articulated in the Lawler case, how do we review this de novo?
I think that you go through the Lawler case and the factors in the Lawler case and say whether there's been an abuse of discretion.
What did the Court of Appeals find was violated in the Lawler case? What did they focus on that said this was the factor that constitutes an abuse of discretion, so that we could then review that de novo?
I understand the difficulty, Your Honor. I mean, I had the difficulty in writing this brief for the same reasons. But unfortunately, when in these expedited bond motions, I mean, this is how they're often dealt with by order. And if there is any basis in the record to say that there was an abuse of discretion, and there is here, as I have laid out the reasons for, I think this court can reach this case de novo and make that decision.
Well, I don't mean this as criticism of you, so please don't take it that way, all right? Don't you think someone's liberty deserves a bit more attention by the court that reviews it?
I
know you didn't have anything to do with it, all right? So
sure
please don't take it that way. But I mean, people take these bond motions and say, oh, it's just a bond motion, and move it on. You know, I presume this is a single-judge review.
I'm sure that they have a lot of bond motions
I'm presuming this is a single-judge review, all right? I sat on the Court of Appeals. I know who prepares those orders. I know how it works. And I'm wondering whether or not insufficient attention from the Court of Appeals is the reason for this case being here today.
And, Your Honor, that may be. And I understand your issue or your question about whether to remand it. And if the court finds that I don't think that there's sufficient evidence in the record to say that they applied an incorrect standard of review. Perhaps more information is needed, and the prudent thing would be to send it back to them to flesh it out. But I would argue that there's no evidence in this record on that order that shows that they applied something incorrectly, perhaps didn't give enough information for this court to be able to rule. If I would like to just talk briefly about, in case you don't agree with me and think that perhaps the court needs to reach the abuse of discretion here.
That would be a good idea, counsel.
I would talk about a bit about under Lawler why this was an abuse of discretion. And I first want to say that this is not an argument that's barred by Rule 525. And the reason is because all of these facts were developed below, and the Commonwealth's attorney argued that this was an abuse of discretion. Those words were in his motion and in his brief in opposition. The fact that I've cited a different case in discussing that standard does not mean that that argument is barred under Rule 525 under Perry, because I am the appellee in this circumstance. Under Lawler, there are several ways that the court can abuse its discretion. And I think the pertinent ways here are when proper factors are not considered. But I would argue that the issue here is when irrelevant or improper factors are considered and given significant weight, or when all proper factors are considered but the court commits clear errors in judgment. And the reason here why I would argue that there was an abuse of discretion is because the type of evidence that was proffered, and I would argue, Your Honors, that the record in this case, in determining what the trial court did, should be limited to page 29 through 41 of the joint appendix. Because even counsel, during argument at the motion to stay, I believe, which was later on, said, objected to the Commonwealth introducing new evidence of bruising to this woman's chest area, and said, this is not a motion to rehear. And so because that evidence was not considered, the evidence that should be reviewed on bond in this matter, on appellate review, appears between pages 29 and 41 of the joint appendix. And much of what is proffered, because this is the nature of these types of cases, is some is argument and some is proffer. And of course, proffer is competent evidence, but some of these things that were stated were not proffers of evidence even, but were just opinions or arguments of counsel. And so, for example, and were completely irrelevant to whether this man is a danger to the community. For example, whether he has an interest in genealogy, I would argue, is completely irrelevant to whether he is a danger to the community. Apparently, he has other hobbies that are not so benign. Is a vanilla type of person. This is an argument. This is not a proffer. I mean, this is counsel's argument and opinion on what type of person this gentleman is. In contrast, what we have is, frankly, a parade of horribles of allegations that he did to a 79-year-old woman that involved five ways in which there was a presumption against bond in this case. Presumptions because three acts of violence that qualify for presumption against bond under 19.2.120 and two potential life sentences. But that's just the cake. In addition to that, there's the icing, and that is the really horrific, as the court described them, facts in this case that were proffered by the Commonwealth's attorney about what this man did to his neighbor when in his condo. Over and above that, the fact that he is a convicted sex offender. He did all of this while a convicted sex offender and on the sexual offender registry. Now, the fact that he has not had a new conviction in 10 years or while living in this condo association, and the fact that these other crimes may have not involved very young children, well, maybe relevant, although I don't know what relevance there is as to the age of the child, does not rebut the presumption. At most,
it mitigates maybe slightly the icing on, but it has absolutely no relevance and does not rebut the presumption against bond in this case. So what we have from his counsel at trial is his representation that he was a vanilla sort of person, that he had ties to the community. And we're not arguing that he's a flight risk. I mean, I don't think that the Commonwealth argued that below, and we are certainly not positing that now. But he is a danger to the community, and he is a danger to the community because of the allegations against him, because of the fact that he had previous convictions for the same thing and was on the sexual offender registry at the time. And the types of evidence that was proffered, and I would take issue with, well, the court could observe him in his interactions with counsel. This gentleman did not testify, so there is no decision as to his credibility. He didn't testify. I mean, I would argue that you can't look at someone when they're standing there with counsel and say, well, this guy looks like a really bad guy. I don't like the way he looks, so I'm going to revoke his bond. I mean, until he testifies and says something, I mean, if there's some interaction that can't be pointed to, perhaps, there were no factual findings in this case that are entitled to deference. The judge didn't make any factual findings. And this is different from the type of case, like a sufficiency case, where we know what the court decided. We know that the court decided that the evidence was sufficient beyond a reasonable doubt for guilt. This is a discretionary call, but that discretion is limited by the presumption against bond. It's a discretionary call, and it is a weighing of factors. And because the judge did not say what factors he was weighing, there is no factual finding here. So, and he didn't even mention the presumption against bond and say how it was rebutted. So for those reasons, if you reach the issue and do not send it back to the Court of Appeals, I would ask that you find that there is an abuse of discretion here, unless the court has
You want us to make that finding?
If you decide that, well, I...
See, part of the dilemma is that I think you're right about our standard review. I think our standard is de novo from the Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I can't figure out what to review de novo. And as a result, I have to, according to the Commonwealth, I have to review this as an abuse of discretion standard by going all the way back to the circuit court and handling the matter as if we were the Court of Appeals. That's the dilemma.
Well, I mean, I think the difficulty is, and I think I mentioned this on brief, is that there is no corresponding Supreme Court rule that talks about what the standard of review is if somebody appeals from the Court of Appeals.
So you have picked out, you have alleged in your brief or maintained that we have a de novo standard. The rule says in bond things it's abuse of discretion. Is it abuse of discretion all the way through the system up to us?
Well, there's a little bit of, I think that the difficulty here is that you are called upon to rule on the legal determination of the Court of Appeals, and that is a de novo standard. That's a de novo standard. Their legal determinations, whether it was correct or incorrect, is a de novo standard. I cannot see any reason why this court would apply a different standard of review than the Court of Appeals would. I mean, I'm aware of no circumstance where this court hears evidence anew.
5A means it's a rule that applies in the Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor.
We don't have a corresponding
rule. That's true.
As a result, you have maintained that we review the Court of Appeals on a de novo standard. I think you're right.
Yes.
But I don't know what to look at to determine if they erred.
And the only thing that I can say to you, Your Honor, is that it makes no sense. And, I mean, there's obviously a gap. There should be a corresponding rule that, because, I mean, if somebody appeals to this court from the Court of Appeals, how do you decide whether there was an abuse of discretion? I mean, how do you reach the ultimate question? Or do you just send it back every time? I mean, there has to be some mechanism to review, and it makes no sense to, well, I mean, in this circumstance, if you have to review what the circuit court did, I mean, how can you decide whether there's error if you don't use an abuse of discretion standard?
example, right?
It's a quandary, and I understand that, but I think that that there is no corresponding rule. It's a de novo standard. And the question presented in this case, quite frankly, calls upon this court to make a determination about the court's about the Court of Appeals' legal determination. So maybe that's the answer.
All right, thank you. Mr. Greenspun, you have 4 minutes and 49 seconds left.
Thank you. First, on a couple of specific points from the record, the Commonwealth now reiterates, as Mr. Shapiro did in the Circuit Court on the motion to stay, that there was not a risk of flight issue, but simply the day before, page 33 of the appendix, Mr. Freeman, who heard argued the bond motion in the Circuit Court, stated why is a risk to the community and so on, and then said that there are no conditions that would guarantee his appearance in court because he has been in Colorado and Nebraska. The next day, the other prosecutor says it's really not a risk of flight. Now Ms. Bourne says it's really not a risk of flight issue. It just shows that the Commonwealth is a bit all over the place as far as what their position is. And the Circuit Court judge saw that and could take that all into consideration, certainly as far as what Mr. Freeman said versus what Mr. Shapiro said. As far as the page 29 to 41 of the appendix being what should be considered, in fact, on the motion to stay, I did object. I did object to the Commonwealth sort of re-arguing the bond motion as far as the motion to stay is concerned, and as is typically the case, Judge Schell told me I was wrong, and he overruled the objection, and he let the Commonwealth go on, and that's a page 49. So the representation that the court didn't have that subsequent argument about the factors is wrong. The judge considered further propers in overruling my objection. I've been trying to consider further about the issue of what happens on remand and where this goes. This matter is set for trial at the end of April, about April 22nd. We've now had the preliminary hearing, which is not part of the record here, so I can't refer to it in particular. But the facts and circumstances even have changed since that because of what we got out of the preliminary hearing, which is contrary to some of the proffers. I'm not saying that as a matter of record. I'm saying that these cases have life. They have ups and downs, and all the while Mr. Shannon is sitting in the Fairfax County Adult Detention Center based on the Court of Appeals, if you will, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but non-ruling, or ruling without specifics. He has been and continues every day to be prejudiced by the fact that the Court of Appeals did not appropriately look at this. And so to send this back to the Court of Appeals under the circumstances, when this man has been prejudiced for 3 or so months now, pending trial, where we really don't have the ability to go back and say the facts that they put out are wrong as far as bond is concerned, to get it back before this court because it wouldn't be part of the record, would be wrongful as to Mr. Shannon. If there's something new that the Commonwealth has come up with as far as risk to the community or risk to the complaining witness or risk of flight, as in any case, they can address that back to the Circuit Court. And that's the appropriate remedy, and hopefully I've said it with a little more clarity now as to why I think it should go back to the Circuit Court as opposed to the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.
Yeah.